Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When your business travel is out of balance, you feel it. At National Car Rental, you're in control. Skip the counter, choose any car in the aisle, and manage your rental right from the app. So you can balance the boardroom with the not-so-board. Climb rocks after you rock your presentation. And mix work with leisure. Or leisure with work. Find the perfect balance with National Car Rental. Subject to availability and other restrictions, requires enrollment in the complimentary Emerald Club.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Friday, the 28th of April, these are our main stories. Both sides in the conflict in Sudan have agreed to extend the ceasefire for another 3 days, even though the current truce has not been fully observed. Washington has imposed new sanctions on Russia's FSB intelligence agency and Iran's Revolutionary Guards, accusing them of taking Americans hostage. And the World Bank predicts global food prices will fall sharply this year, but will remain relatively high because of the war in Ukraine. Also in this podcast.
Never assume that because the ex is out of the house, that the ex is out of the picture. Till next time, take care of yourself and each other.
Jerry Springer, the talk show host, has died aged 79. We'll look back at his career. We begin in Sudan, and as we record this podcast, there are reports of heavy fighting in parts of the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, even though a ceasefire is meant to be in place. Both the Sudanese army and the rival Rapid Support Forces have said they're prepared to extend the 3-day truce, which expired at midnight local time on Thursday. Almost 2 weeks of clashes between the two factions have left hundreds of people dead and forced tens of thousands from their homes. Diplomatic efforts to persuade the two rival generals to stop the fighting have been continuing, with the UN, the US and African countries all involved. Here's our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams, who's in Nairobi.
The fate of Sudan's shaky truce hangs in the balance. Throughout much of the past 3 days, gunfire has reverberated around the capital. But now the two sides both say they're willing to extend the ceasefire, offering just a glimmer of hope. A spokesman for the Rapid Support Forces said the paramilitary group was committed to what it called a humanitarian armistice, which recognised what the people of Sudan were going through and facilitated the continued evacuation of foreign nationals. But the spokesman also blamed the Sudanese military for using artillery and jets to attack RSF bases and civilian neighbourhoods. This new truce has clearly been the result of concerted international pressure, especially from the United States and Saudi Arabia. But no one is celebrating. In Washington, the White House spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre said the situation was unlikely to improve.
This is a dynamic environment, and any option entails a degree of risk. But because the situation is unlikely to improve, we encourage Americans who want to leave to take advantage of the options that are available to them in the next 24 to 48 hours.
The first truce was frequently broken. The new one is unlikely to be very different.
That was Paul Adams. So what is life like for the people still in Khartoum? Mariam El-Sadiq El-Mahdi was the foreign minister in the civilian government. She's at home in Bahri, known as North Khartoum. Tim Franks asked her what she's seeing.
I am hearing, I'm not seeing anything because we are trying to be inside our homes because I'm in an area where there is engagement most of the time. There is air bombardment followed by the anti-aircraft. So we try our best not to get out. And anyway, we are out of electricity for 2 days. We are out of any water supply for the last 13 days. We are trying to manage with the few water we have for our own consumption, though it's already polluted water, but we are using it anyway. We are besieged inside our homes. Most of the time, try to go outside, not taking any four-wheel drive cars because you get yourself killed for having four-wheel drive car. So we manage with small cars. in groups. The men, they go to fetch the water and to fetch basic things like sugar, flour, and or such things, very basic things. There is a very serious fighting going for the last 13 days. The fighters are taking the people, the civilians, as human shields because they are blending themselves in the most highly populated neighborhoods of the capital. It's a nightmare.
Mariam, I can hear from all that you've said that it sounds like it's terrifying and it's depressing what you're having to live through at the moment. And it also sounds as if, despite the international efforts to extend the ceasefire, you're saying that you haven't seen much evidence of a ceasefire over the last few days. What do you think of the chances in that case of the efforts right now to start proper peace talks between the two men, Hameti and Burhan, the two generals who are fighting? I mean, there are efforts, we're told, they're going to be led by South Sudan to broker in-depth peace negotiations between the two. What do you think the chances are?
Well, I think it's very meager because the two fighting men are, one of them is supposedly to be the head of the Sovereign Council, the number one ruler of Sudan, and the second one is his deputy. They are the one who are supposed to be responsible of the well-being protection of the Sudanese people. They couldn't, for the last 13 days, find a way to look at the Sudanese people as humans and to have ceasefire, humanitarian ceasefire, for only 6 hours, because now they got into personal vendetta against each other. It is no more something that is sensible or something that is built on any rationale. They look at us only as strategic military gains.
Mariam El-Sadiq El-Mahdi, Sudan's former foreign minister. The United States has imposed sanctions on Russia's domestic security service, the FSB. It said the agency, the successor of the Soviet KGB, was guilty of hostage-taking. Similar sanctions were imposed on the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. The details from Barbara Plettacher in Washington.
This is the first time the U.S. is imposing sanctions for the wrongful detention of Americans. Administration officials said it was part of a broader effort to deal with the practice of using U.S. citizens as political bargaining chips. That's what they've accused Russia and Iran of doing. The sanctions target Russia's Domestic Security Service, the FSB, as well as the intelligence unit of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps, including four of its senior commanders. Some are already sanctioned for other reasons, but the official said it was important to show there were consequences for this behavior and more sanctions would be coming.
Barbara Plettacher. President Erdogan of Turkey has appeared on television for the first time since he fell ill on Tuesday and cancelled his engagements in a crucial election campaign. He spoke via video link at an event to open Turkey's first nuclear power plant built by Russia. Also on the giant screen was President Putin. As we reported in the earlier podcast, there has been speculation about Mr. Erdogan's health just 3 weeks before Turkey holds presidential and parliamentary polls. Our senior international correspondent, Orla Girin, who's in Istanbul, told us how Mr. Erdogan appeared.
Well, he certainly did not look the picture of health. He appeared on a video screen rather than in person. I thought he looked quite tired and weary. He spoke for several minutes. His voice was reasonably strong, but it was significant that he missed this event in person. This was a historic moment for Turkey, the opening of the country's first nuclear power station, which was in fact built by Russia. So he was paying tribute to Russia and thanking Russia. And he said that this was a moment to celebrate because Turkey was finally, after a delay of 60 years, joining the group of nuclear countries. I think the aim on the part of his officials was to send the message that the president was back on his feet, if you like, but he didn't look particularly well or strong, and we don't yet know whether he will resume all of the planned activities on the campaign trail in the coming days. The timing of all of this really is critical for the president because he's in the fight of his life for re-election.
Absolutely. The election's, what, 3 weeks away? How much of an issue is his health for voters now?
I think it's an issue because it's being talked about. This is a very public discussion in Turkey this week. When he became ill on Tuesday night, it was during a live TV broadcast, which really startled the viewers. and got people concerned about this. Now, the camera was not on the president when it happened. It was on the interviewer. But in the background, you could hear a sort of a kerfuffle and somebody saying, oh, dear, oh, dear. And then the interviewer looked quite panic-stricken, suddenly stood up, and the programme went to an unscheduled commercial break. And it was 20 minutes before it came back on the air. Now, when it did resume transmission, the president was there himself, looking extremely tired. He apologised and said that he had been working hard, travelling a lot, and he had picked up a stomach bug. And that is the official line from the Turkish government. Turkey's health minister, Ferhatin Koca, said today that the president was now recovering from a bout of gastroenteritis and that his overall health was good. Officials are trying to be reassuring about the state of the president's health, but there's been such a clamour, including claims on social media that he had a heart attack, that his own communications team had to come out and officially deny that.
That was all a Guerin. NATO says it has delivered almost all the combat vehicles promised to Ukraine ahead of its expected spring offensive against Russian forces. The alliance says it's also delivered vast amounts of ammunition. But there's evidence that Ukraine is still having to ration munitions. Our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale has sent this report from the front line in eastern Ukraine.
In the east, Ukrainian forces are holding the line. Still mostly relying on old Soviet weaponry. Like this 50-year-old D-20 artillery gun. But after more than a year of fighting, they're now having to use ammunition sparingly. In the space of an hour, this team fires just two shells.
Everybody's come back to the bunker after firing that round. Relative safety in case the Russians return fire.
It's a similar story further along the front line, where another team are preparing to fire their Grad rocket launcher, another Soviet-era weapon.
They're just lining up the Grad rockets now to hit a target. We're told a mortar position, a Russian mortar position, about 17 kilometres away.
Their Grad has 40 barrels. Vladimir, the commander, says a year ago, at the start of the war, they were firing a full salvo within 20 seconds. Now, he says, they can only afford to fire a few at a time.
We haven't got enough for our older Soviet-era weapons. If we'd fired more, we might have been able to give more support to our guys who are dying. But we don't have enough ammo for our grads. Earlier, at the beginning, a year ago, we worked with full packages. 40 barrels makes a package. But we are running low. We've got rockets from the Czech Republic, Romania and Pakistan. The ones from Pakistan are not of good quality.
We're driving on the road into Bakhmut now, just on the edges of the city, and we're driving at speed because we're told that all of this road is now in range of Russian artillery.
Ukrainian forces on the outskirts of Bakhmut do have some Western weapons, but most, like modern tanks and armoured vehicles, are being kept in reserve for the coming offensive. Its place and timing still unclear.
Smell of cordite filling the air now. They're going to fire a second round. These British light artillery guns are trained on the city of Bakhmut, where Ukrainian forces are still just clinging on. These defensive operations in the east of Ukraine are consuming huge resources, manpower, weapons and ammunition. Well, at the same time, Ukraine is trying to prepare for a major offensive. And it's hard to do both. So, this is a British gun?
Yeah.
L119, yeah?
Serhii and his team also say they need more ammunition. They're already having to ration what they use to around 30 rounds a day.
If you don't succeed this year, will you lose the war?
If we go on the offensive this year and take back our land, then we will win. If this does not happen, we haven't got resources for the war to go on for 5 or 10 years.
With finite resources, exhaustion, and limits to Western support, Ukraine knows this could be its make-or-break year.
Jonathan Beale in eastern Ukraine. The World Bank has forecast that global food prices will fall by 8% this year, but it says that food will still be more expensive than at any time in nearly 50 years, largely due to the war in Ukraine. Here's Jonathan Josephs.
This World Bank report predicts that record high food prices are now firmly in reverse, with an 8% fall expected this year. Energy, where prices have already shown big drops, will be down more than 25%. However, it cautions that cheaper food depends on exports from Ukraine remaining stable. A UN brokered deal to keep them flowing expires next month, and Russia says it wants concessions from the West to extend it again. Food prices remain near 50-year highs, and the World Bank warns the number of people facing food insecurity has grown to 349 million.
Jonathan Josephs. A court in Germany has thrown out an eggnog maker's claim that one of its rivals had copied its advertising slogan. In case you don't know, eggnog is a drink consisting of rum, brandy or other alcohol mixed with beaten egg, milk and sugar. The German manufacturer Vapurten had argued that the rival motto, which repeated the German word for egg, was too similar to its own. Our Berlin correspondent Jenny Hill reports.
They might not admit it, but almost every German could sing along to this advertising slogan. The drinks manufacturer Vapurten has used it for decades to sell its Eierlikör, or egg liqueur, a sweet, viscous drink as yellow as the yolks from which it's made. Eierlikör is a popular tipple here, particularly during Easter celebrations, when it's customary to sip the spirit from a chocolate beaker. Executives at Vapurten, whose trademarked advert repeats the word Ei, which is the German for egg, three times, were furious when a rival manufacturer recently unveiled their new slogan, which featured the word five times. Vapurten's lawyers tried to have it banned, but today Düsseldorf's higher regional court ruled that the rival hadn't infringed on their trademark. It was, judges added, hardly reasonable to expect an egg liqueur manufacturer not to refer to the most important ingredient.
Jenny Hill. Still to come, new evidence of just how far the Roman Empire extended. We'll be right back after this.
15 years ago, 23-year-old Norwegian student Martine Vik Magnussen was killed in an apartment near Mayfair.
23-year-old Martine Vik Magnussen was found partially buried in the basement.
Before being questioned, the only suspect in the case had fled the UK to Yemen. I made a promise to Martina's family to find out what happened. Murder in Mayfair, part of the documentary. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And we're back. The US Navy has demanded the immediate release of a Houston-bound oil tanker seized by Iran in the Gulf of Oman. The Fifth Fleet described the action as contrary to international law. Here's Mike Thompson.
Iran claims the Marshall Islands flag tanker Advantage Suite was seized after it crashed into an Iranian vessel, leaving two crew members missing and several injured. But the US Navy says the incident is yet another example of Tehran's continued harassment of ships in the Gulf. A spokesman said over the past 2 years, Iran has seized at least five commercial vessels in the region. The incident comes just days after the US, Britain and the EU toughened sanctions against the country's Revolutionary Guards, citing human rights violations.
That was Mike Thompson. Now to Uganda, where 11 women opposition MPs were arrested while taking part in a protest march against police brutality.
Why are you taking me?
The women were trying to deliver a petition to the Internal Affairs Ministry when they were put into police vehicles and taken to the main police station in the capital, Kampala. They were released later in the day. Patience Atuhede, our correspondent in Kampala, told us why the MPs were protesting.
They say that on several occasions, the police forces have intercepted their meetings, their rallies, and broken them up, beaten them up, violently arrested them and their supporters and constituents. And they say that this hasn't happened just once. It has happened several times in different constituencies. And these are all opposition women MPs. So last week, one woman MP attempted to belatedly organize Women's Day celebrations for her supporters in her constituency. And there's video of her being violently grabbed and dragged and arrested, and her supporters also beaten.
So these are 11 MPs, 11 elected representatives. They were trying to protest. Why were they arrested?
The police forces say that their march was not cleared by the police. Now, under the Public Order Management Act, anyone that's organizing a demonstration or a protest or a rally or even any large meeting has to notify the police and get clearance. So the police forces said that they were disrupting traffic and causing confusion on the streets, but also that they were inciting violence, and that is why they were rounded up and arrested. There are pictures from local media of some of them being pulled by their hair, bundled into a truck. In one of the videos, they are complaining that tear gas had been lobbed into the very car that the police was insisting on transporting them in. And we understand the Speaker of Parliament went to the police station herself and negotiated their release.
So it's been brought up in Parliament, I understand.
I think one of the reasons Parliament is very concerned, it's because these are some of their own. They are women MPs, they are legislators, they are high-profile people. So I think the concern is, if this can be done to MPs, what then happens to ordinary people?
Have there been any statements from the police force about how they conduct themselves?
We haven't heard from the police on this particular incident and if they will take any action against their officers. But earlier this week, the police did say that they'd summoned 11 of their officers who were involved in the alleged arrest and torture of that woman MP last week who tried to organise a Women's Day rally.
That was Patience Aduhede. As India becomes the world's most populous country, food security for its people is a big challenge. At the top of that list, edible oils to cook with. Each year, the country spends billions of dollars on importing almost 70% of the edible oils it needs. So now it plans to produce more at home by using genetic technology, starting with mustard seeds. The BBC's Davina Gupta has been finding out more.
If you find yourself in a farm in the North Indian state of Uttar Pradesh in the winter season, one thing you can't miss is this sound of tractors. These are big red and black machines moving around the field in between the crops as well. And one of the crops in these fields is bound to be of big green stems with yellow flowers. This crop is locally called sarso. From its shoots to leaves, flowers and seeds, all the parts are used in cooking in India. But perhaps it's the seeds which are the most important part from which edible oil is extracted. An estimated 6 million farmers grow this crop around the country. Among them is 48-year-old Kulwant Singh.
I was born to a family which has been farming for generations. I primarily cultivate wheat and sugarcane crops, but I've reserved 10 acres of land for mustard.
So how much do you earn from it?
I get about 60 quintals of mustard crop, and with each quintal, we get about 30 kgs of mustard oil. So my profit in a good season is around $400 when I sell this crop to a trader to take out the oil.
And what's the biggest challenge for you to grow this crop?
The biggest challenge for us is that we are seeing temperatures getting higher in winters, so the shoot of the plant is drying faster and is prone to fungus. We can't use a chemical spray to kill them, as it will impact the crop as well.
And that's becoming a problem. Already the demand for vegetable oils from soybeans to palm and mustard is so high that India has to get a bulk of it from outside the country. And that's why India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has been sharing this message.
सिर्फ गेहूं चावल चीनी में ही आत्मनिर्भरता काफी नहीं है.
It's not enough to have self-reliance in wheat, rice and sugar crops. But it is vital that we become self-reliant in pulses and edible oils.
So one solution that the country has been exploring is a genetically modified version of edible oil crops. Professor Deepak Pentel is in his early 70s. He's credited for developing the first ever food-based GM crop in India. He and his team have worked for years on mustard seeds and have made a genetically modified version called Dhara Mustard 11 or DMH 11. Professor Pentel tells me how he started the project in the early 90s.
Around 1993-94, we were working on mustard because it's an important oil seed crop of India. So hybrids yield more than pure line varieties. If you have 20 to 30% more yield, then the amount of oil also increases by 20 to 30%.
It's taken over two decades for Professor Pentel and his team to get environmental clearance from India's Genetic Engineering Appraisal Committee. And that's a big step, but not everyone's happy. Many food activists have questioned the safety of GM food crops and have asked the courts to step in.
That report by Davina Gupta. The Roman Empire hit its heights two millennia ago, but we're still finding new evidence of just how far it extended. The latest discoveries are rather well-preserved remains of Roman military camps in areas of what is now Jordan, where previously we didn't know there'd been Roman military activity. Dr. Michael Fradley of Oxford University led the research.
Using satellite imagery, we identified a line of three Roman camps, which are temporary military structures that were built when the Roman army was on campaign. And this was down in southeast Jordan, where we weren't expecting any structures of this type. There's no Roman history of campaigning in this region. They're in an incredibly desolate part of the landscape, even in North Arabia, you know, this desert region. This is a particularly empty zone. I mean, you can see from the photographs, a few kind of off-road vehicles have driven over them at times, but it's a landscape that people do not inhabit. So it's a case of they haven't been spotted, and they also, positively for us, haven't been damaged. Just from this evidence, we can't say exactly what they were doing or when they were doing it, but we speculate, in terms of what we know, that although there's no documented history of a campaign in this region, we know that this area, what was formerly the Nabataean Kingdom, so centered on places like Petra, that the Romans annexed it after 106 CE, so the beginning of the second century. And we suspect that maybe it's part of a campaign, although the official history is that you have a peaceful annexation, that the kingdom's just handed over for the good of the kingdom, that maybe, certainly on the outliers of that kingdom, there was resistance and you have this kind of military action to subdue that resistance.
Dr. Michael Fradley. The talk show host Jerry Springer has died at the age of 79. With an initial background in politics, Jerry Springer went on to explore the relationships between people for hugely dramatic televisual entertainment, exploiting everyday confrontations between ordinary people before resolving the conflicts or not. His television show ran from 1991 to 2018, but Jerry Springer had a long and varied career in a number of different spheres. Born in a London tube station, yes, really, at the end of the Second World War, he accompanied his family to America and credited that move with giving him a sense of possibilities. Here he is speaking to us in 2008.
My parents believed in the promise of Miss Liberty, Statue of Liberty, when we sailed to America in 1949 on the Queen Mary. My mom told me in later years that when we sailed past the Statue of Liberty, I'd ask her, what does that mean? Because everyone was oohing and aahing about it. And she said in the German she spoke at the time, Ein Tag alles, one day everything. And she was right. In America, all things were possible. So in one generation, my family went from extermination to this ridiculously privileged life I live today because of my silly show. So, yeah, America works.
Jerry Springer was interviewed by Stephen Sacker on the BBC Hard Talk programme in 2014, and he outlined to him some of the unusual items on his show.
fairly typical of your show, for people who don't know it, would be the sort of titles that you churned out: Pregnant by a Transsexual, Stripper Wars, Honey, I'm a Call Girl, My Girlfriend is a Guy. These are all titles
that was
I took
a great
from the,
one.
I took these from the 90s, but as your ratings got higher and this audience of yours grew more and more, quote unquote, crazy, you went for shows like I Married My Horse.
Yeah.
About a guy who'd had a 5-year sexual romantic relationship with
a horse. We don't know sexual.
That was the implication of the show.
Well, if they're married, you think about it, but yeah.
But my point is, even a lot of the affiliates across the United States who took your show couldn't take that one. They said it was too extreme, too off the wall.
It was.
Why did you decide that was the kind of TV you wanted to make? And were you proud of it?
Well, yeah, I'm proud of my show. Why wouldn't I be? But beyond that...
Because it's stupid.
Well, yes, it's a stupid show. I always say our show is stupid. But it, for 1 hour, it's an escape from regular life.
Our arts correspondent David Sillitoe takes a look back at the life of politician-turned-TV ringmaster.
When you ask most people, how was your day, they tend to say, fine, I was in the office. When people ask me, I say, I met someone who married a horse.
And we went to his home, and the hallways in the home were extra wide because the horse lived inside the home with him.
Okay. Jerry Springer was for many years regularly cited as a sign of America's moral decay. His gloriously chaotic talk show was often more a fight show, punctuated with some shouting.
Tammy claims that Angie slept with all three of her husbands.
The urbane, witty ringmaster owed much to his ever-vigilant security guards. And his first career was politics, eventually becoming mayor of Cincinnati. A political advert in which he discussed a moment from his past.
I spent time with a woman I shouldn't have, and I paid her with a check. I wish I hadn't done that.
He was honest, but not very successful. But the clever, funny and politically shrewd failed politician was perfect for a new talk show, which was, at the beginning, quite serious. He soon realised where the ratings were. He was utterly unashamed of the nonsense. And when it was parodied as an opera, he was there in the audience in Edinburgh, enjoying the chaos and outrage. And after a life such as this, a final thought? Well, Jerry was the master of final thoughts. Let's leave it to him.
There's never been a moment in the 25 years of doing this show that I ever thought I was better than the people who appear on our stage. I'm not better, only luckier.
David Sillitoe on the life of the talk show host Jerry Springer, who has died at the age of 79. And you can hear Jerry Springer's Hard Talk interview, which was recorded in 2014, at bbcworldservice.com. or wherever you get your podcasts. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics we've covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Holly Palmer. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, take care of yourselves and each other.
In 2015, Shamima Begum and her two school friends travelled to Syria to join the Islamic State group.
Breaking news this morning, three British schoolgirls are reportedly missing.
Shamima Begum was the only one of the girls to emerge from the ashes of the so-called caliphate. And now she wants to come home.
What do you think people think of you?
As a danger, as a potential risk.
The Shamima Begum Story, Series 2 of I'm Not a Monster. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.